Association football is the most popular outdoor sport in Britain. Thousands play and millions watch the game. In the north of England, in the great centres of manufacture and industry, football plays an even greater part in the life of the people. Everywhere in Britain, you'll find boys playing football. On public playing fields, in school yards, and even in the streets. Anywhere will do.
Hello and welcome to episode one of The Echo. This is a brand new series from me, Sean, of the Keeping Up Appearances podcast. Now, this is a bit of a move away from our usual content. Obviously, we are very much in the habit of talking about modern football and dropping names of Barclaysmen and the likes. This is obviously going a little bit further back in terms of football history. So I'll quickly tell you how I came up with the idea and why I wanted to do this podcast so much. It came to me, to be honest, a few weeks ago as we said goodbye to Goodison Park when, against Southampton, Goodison closed its gates for the final time after 133 years. After the game, you may have seen it, there was a bit of a farewell service, if that's what you want to call it, and part of it, arguably the highlight of it, was all of the ex-players parading around the pitch. These players came in chronological order, which meant it was quite easy to work out where your era was, where your team was. Obviously, me and people my age, it was the back end, 90s, 2000s, that era. But it started with players from the 60s and 70s. And Gethin Jones on the pitch, he named every single one of them. And I was probably, I'd maybe say, a bit disappointed in myself at how few of the players I actually knew. I'd heard of one or two. And yeah, I kind of felt like I was doing a disservice to these players. Not that you can know every player that's ever played for your club, but it was obviously apparent, especially from speaking to family and knowing stories of Everton of old, these players who were walking around, these now old men, walking around the pitch with so much history in their lives and so many achievements and so much success for Everton and on this pitch. And I'd go as far as to say 90% of that ground probably don't know who they are. And I just thought it was quite sad. I don't feel like if we were to move forward 40 years, I don't feel like the current players will be forgotten in the same way. They've left a bigger footprint in social media presence or the 24/7 news that is talked about and footballers. I don't think they will be forgotten in the same way. And I thought, I really want to learn more myself, to be fair. If I can help anyone else to learn about these players and if anyone else is interested in the same way as me, that's great. But I just wanted to use this as a platform to do some learning. So everything you hear in this podcast, I can assure you I'm no expert. This is just me kind of learning, picking things up and processing it in my own way. And the best way to do that is to maybe tell other people. So that's what we're getting from this podcast. Today's episode focuses on an English centre-back. Okay, now if I said to you, think of an English centre-back, I'd be very surprised if this player's name even entered your head. I, for one, I'll be honest, I'd never heard of this player before I chose him for today. Then once I knew of him, I did some research and I'm really glad I chose this player. And I hope in some way the information can be taken on and passed on to people because he is a fascinating player and a fascinating man as well. So this man, of course, is Neil Franklin, who was born on January 24th, 1922 in Staffordshire. Now, obviously, as you can tell from the year of birth, these are the interwar years. So he's just missed World War I and he's growing up in that time in between World War One and World War Two. Obviously, doesn't know World War Two will come very soon and will end up going slap bang in the middle of his promising football career at the time. So while he was younger and while war was a distant cloud, he, from a very early age, joined Stoke's academy setup, which back then they were called nursery clubs. So Stoke's nursery club was called Stoke Old Boys, and Franklin played there from a young age. He impressed, as you would expect them to, and when he was ready, he took some steps into senior football. He graduated into Stoke's first team and in the process managed to get some youth international honours. So playing for England in those teenage years, you could tell, I imagine at the time, just from reading about him as well, you could tell this is a player, obviously, who you would have high hopes for. The reason I think he stood out from testimonials I've heard about him is that he didn't seem to fit in this world of football of the 1930s. As I'm sure you've seen from any photos or videos or people talking about the game, it's a different world to what it is now. The pitches were muddy, the balls were heavy and leather, and the game was very, very physical. A defender in that world played probably as I do. Maybe I belong in this generation, and they would get the ball and they'd boot it. Quite simple, okay? And then they let the creative players do all the work. Franklin didn't do that. Franklin played like a modern day centre back, like a modern day defender. He loved being on the ball. He'd play out from the back and he'd take players on. This was probably a bit of a shock for those attacking players who he was coming up against, who aren't used to defenders doing this. They'd never really had to defend themselves. So the fact that they now had a defender who was potentially more creative than they were, it made them stand out a mile off. I'm not sure what the correct word is, but a throwback is somebody that feels like they belong in a generation of the past. Maybe he's a throw forward. I don't know if that's a word, but I quite like it. I might coin it. So I'd say maybe Franklin's a throw forward, play like a modern day player, way, way ahead of his time. And it made him so unique that it was almost inevitable that he was going to go on to have a great career. Did that career go according to plan? Stick with me to find out. Before long, war came again, and the world was put on hold, including, obviously, football. Now, it's kind of like when football was put on hold during the COVID years. Probably a much more extreme version of the COVID years, but football was put on hold. There were many footballers who spent the war years fighting. Neil Franklin, fortunately for him, maybe didn't have to do that. However, he did volunteer for the Royal Air Force in 1941 as a 19-year-old, and he was stationed near Blackpool. As I said, football was put on hold, as in competitive games were put on hold, but he still managed to turn out for the Royal Air Force, gaining lots of experience playing against different types of players. And he also played for Stoke in friendlies and regional games as they tried to maybe stay afloat as a club and maybe give people a bit of togetherness. Maybe they needed that during the wartime. He ended up making 186 appearances during this time for Stoke, but also managed to represent England 10 times during wartime internationals. Now, these don't count towards official caps, so take that for what you will. Maybe we should add 10 to his stats, but either way, he gained lots of experience here and he was still playing football. Lots of careers were ruined by the war, whether players got injured, maybe they didn't come back at all, maybe they just spent 5 years not playing football. Franklin was. So by the time the war ended, he was ready to go again, even better than ever. By 1946, he'd earned his first official England cap in a 7-2 victory over Northern Ireland. And he was at this point widely recognised as one of, if not the best centre-back the country and some part of the world had ever seen. Football around this time was dominated by working class men. The industries, working in the mills, working down the mines, working on the docks. Those people were tough, and the game itself was tough. But Franklin, by all accounts, seemed to make it look easy. He was only 5'11", which, 5'11 myself, so I'm not going to say I'm short, but for a centre-back, that probably is quite short now. And he only weighed 11 stone, which is quite lightweight again to be a centre-back. At this point, Stoke City also had legends like Sir Stanley Matthews, who he won't be getting an episode on this because he's too widely known, but this is a team now full of great, great players. And I think from what I've read, it wouldn't be too far to say Franklin was arguably the star of the show, which in a team of Stanley Matthews as well is very impressive. Over the next 4 years then, from his first England cap, he managed to amass 26 and was consistently playing and captaining in the end Stoke City. Now though, we arrive in 1950. This is where it all takes a bit of a turn. This was to be, any World Cup history buffs will know, this was England's first appearance at a World Cup, the World Cup in Brazil. From what we know now about World Cups and England, and most people would do anything to play for their country. However, Franklin made the now infamous decision to not play for England at the 1950 World Cup. If you were like me when you first read it, you might be thinking, why would he do this? And again, you could maybe say representing England wasn't as big of a thing as it is now. World Cups weren't as big of a thing as they are now. However, if you're at the top of your game, you think you would like to almost put yourself in that spotlight. However, Franklin chose not to. And the reason for this was that he'd already signed, unbeknownst to anyone, a deal with Colombian side Independiente Santa Fe. Moving from England to Colombia in the 1950s seems a little bit wild, I agree. The English game back then was very different to how it is now. English football had a wage cap then of £20 a week. And apparently the English FA were very strict on it and were very robust. They would absolutely not change their mind at all. If we fly over then to South America and Colombia, they've broken away from FIFA for these very reasons. A league had been formed to break away from the Colombian Football Association. And this league now almost had no rules. It's maybe in modern day football would see it as what China was 10 years ago or what Saudi Arabia is now. It was a place to go and make money. They had a £60 a week wage, which is obviously three times what you would earn in England, and a £2,000 signing on fee, which is probably three or four times what you'd earn in a year just for signing on. So it almost seemed too good to be true. And it wasn't just Franklin. There were a handful of players making their way over to Colombia. So it felt a bit maybe like Saudi, I'd say now, in that this might become the place everyone wants to go to. They might be the start of something new. And it was big enough. It was a big enough incentive for Franklin to totally abandon his country in the eyes of the FA. And he made the move. He left Stoke City and his new career in Colombia was about to begin. So, he's missed the World Cup. Now we're hoping, or he'd be hoping, I'm sure, that it's worth it. It's a big risk to take. Hopefully it's going to be worth it. Franklin's tenure in Colombia lasted 6 matches before returning to England in August 1950. The problem when he got to Colombia was he realised a very different picture of Colombia had been painted to him. He wasn't paid for the majority of his games that he played, and he wasn't given a signing on fee. The conditions in Colombia, where they were in the midst of a civil war, were not as he'd hoped they would be. The players, the English players over there, felt in danger, and the accommodation wasn't up to scratch. Everything he'd been promised just totally wasn't there. So he came back with his tail between his legs, hoping, maybe, he could pick up his career. At the end of the day, it'd been, what, 2-3 months? How much damage can be done in 2 months? When he stepped foot back on English soil, he was handed an indefinite suspension from playing for England. And his club, Stoke City, still felt that betrayal, and they sold him to Hull for £22,500. A huge amount of money, but it shows that even with a player as good as he was, the betrayal was almost too much. Franklin should be, realistically, the same player he always was. He'd been away a couple of months. That talent should still be there, and it should translate to whatever club he turns out for. You think maybe he could show Stoke and England what they were missing. But unfortunately, it didn't work out like that. He played for Hull before moving to Crewe and then on to Stockport County. And he was very injury prone, meaning he missed lots and lots of playing time. And he ended up retiring after a short while with a bit of a whimper. No big fanfare for the player who had been called the greatest defender of his generation, or the greatest player Hull City had ever had. No fanfare whatsoever. He then took up management, taking on roles in Cyprus before coming back to England and having quite a long but maybe uneventful spell in charge of Colchester United. Fast forward then to Franklin being an old man. In 1996, he passed away in Stoke-on-Trent. His career had taken him as far as Colombia, but unfortunately, when he passed away, he was back in the same place where he was born. He had a life well travelled, but he left only faint marks within football history. And for me, it's almost a shame of what could have been. That, everyone, is a whistle-stop tour of Neil Franklin's career. I'm sure there's bits I've missed. I'm sure there was a lot more to discover about a player like Neil Franklin. However, I'm going to end each episode with a bit of a reflection on what I've taken from learning about this man. I think this one should have two parts, as a player, but also as a man. So Neil Franklin as a player seems to be way, way ahead of his time. He could do things that nobody was even being taught back then. As we know now, footballers from young kids in academies, they're being told how to play. They're being taught it. They're being taught to take the ball from the goalkeeper and play with it. Neil Franklin was doing something he was actively not being told what to do. It's just a talent he had. And you think, had he been born a generation or two later, could he now be sat on the shoulders in 1966 with a World Cup in his hand as a true trailblazer of the game? Maybe. We'll never know, I suppose, and I think that's what makes me quite sad about this. Now, football's not everything, and Franklin may have been happy. He might have loved his life, having a quiet life with no attention. And I think we do put a lot on football ability. My heroes as kids were all footballers, and kids now, they are exactly the same with current players. But I think when you've got someone who's that naturally gifted, as football fans, we want them to achieve what they can. There's nothing worse than wasted potential and missed potential. And I feel like that's what this was now for Franklin. Which leads me into my second part. The reason it was unfulfilled potential was because he took a risk. In those days, you weren't supposed to take risks. You were supposed to do exactly what you were told to do. If somebody put a rule in place about finance, you didn't have any power to challenge it. We know now player power in football is huge. If somebody wants more money, they're getting more money. A club can pretend they're not, but they are. Their agent will make it so. They're getting money whether it's at your club or at the next club. And I think Franklin almost felt that. He felt he was good enough to demand more money and to demand better lifestyle for him and his family. And other players felt the same, but Franklin seemed to have been the one that was punished the most, maybe because he was the best. He was the best player there. And maybe it felt more of a betrayal because of that. So, because he represented a challenge to the way things were governed and the way things were run, maybe his legacy lies in the fact he was a bit of a rebel. And not in a good way, because if this was a film, he would come back and he would show England and he would show Stoke, show them what a player they'd lost. Because I'm very much of the opinion, anyone listening might disagree with me, and you might think he's got a bit of a cheek there asking for more money. In my opinion, if you're good enough, you should be paid for it. You should be paid for your ability and your talent. And I think it's fair to say, if Franklin would have succeeded in doing this, it wouldn't have just been for him, it would have been for every other player out there. They would have followed on. The fact it didn't work maybe set footballers back a couple of years. Players might not have wanted to make that move and took that chance because they maybe think it doesn't work, and the FA maybe have got those players a bit more over a barrel. So I think his fall from the peak of the mountain was so sudden. He was revolutionary in the way he played and revolutionary in the way he thought about football and thought about the business. Neil Franklin saw that back then. He saw what football would become, and he saw what it was to the people watching football, and he dared to ask for a bit more to almost equal what he felt he was giving the game. So I think Neil Franklin, for me, if I'm going to end it on one line, I would say he was a leader in every way, but unfortunately, he didn't get the fairy tale ending. And I think that's what's sad about his story. He will always be a what if. And I think there's lots to learn from players that came before the players that we know now. And I think Neil Franklin is a brilliant example of the good and the bad things about football. Thank you for listening to episode 1 of The Echo. I hope you've enjoyed it. I've certainly enjoyed making it. Maybe it's a teacher in me, wants to get people to learn. I've enjoyed a different side of football history. So yeah, it's been new for me. Hopefully I'll see you back here for episode 2. See you then.